So, what we have been talking about in the sixth chapter of Ecclesiastes is the importance of contentment. Talked about what is not the answer to being happy, and that is all the things that we try to get, gain, or be. But instead, the real truth is that we are content when we have a mindset that brings that contentment despite what might be external. So if we can enjoy life as we have it now instead of always looking for something better, that's going to be a key to contentment. The second page, second section of that, in page 29, is found in verses 10 and 11. Whatever one is, he has been named already, for it is known that he is man. He cannot contend with him who is mightier than he. Since there are many things that increase vanity, how is man the better? And this confession here is twofold here in verses 10 and 11. One is that God is sovereign, that we are man, he is God, and because of that he's in charge. And then second, as a result of that, there is no use in us seeking to argue with him. God, this isn't fair. Why do you do this to me? Why can't it be this way instead of that way? God knows best. God is omnipotent. And it makes no sense to argue with him. My favorite passage in the four that are given there, I think, is the second one in Isaiah 45. Woe to the one who quarrels with his maker. Will the clay say to the potter, what are you doing? Because I think that is exactly what the religion, what the world in general does constantly in our society. Why? And taking issue with the concept of God based upon what we see in the world and their view of how the world should be rather than how it is, and then blaming God for that. They show a lack of understanding as to why things are as they are, and certainly a lack of respect for the Almighty. When you consider who he is and who we are, then it doesn't make any sense to do that. So he seeks to establish that truth as well. So that's kind of just a quick overview of what we've talked about in this chapter. It gets us down to the 12th verse, which says in chapter 6 and verse 12, who knows what is good for man in life, all the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, and who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Now, in regard to this, when you first read that, the who knows question is one that you hear quite often, but the idea is, when that question is asked, is it's unknowable. You know, are you gonna win the lottery? Who knows? How can you know that? There's no way of knowing it. So when you look at this phrase, especially as we've been kind of conditioned in our day, who knows what is good for man in life, it would seem that possibly what he's saying is that who can know what's best? You just have to live your life best you can and hope that it works out for the best. That's kind of an attitude, again, that we see. But that's not really what he's asking. When he's talking in verses 10 and 11 about the sovereignty of God, and that God, in effect, has established man as he intended. He's created the universe as he's intended. Our existence on this earth is as he intended. And you know, there are caveats that we note with regard to that. God didn't intend that man sinned. He just knew he would. But this is the way things are because of man's sin, and this is God's intention to redeem man through his son and all those things. So who knows what is best for us? The answer is God. God does. That's why whenever we offer our prayers, it's so important to pray to him and make intercessions. And I know that a couple of you may be Facebook friends with Emily Vera, and she put a post out this past week talking about sometimes how she struggles with her prayer. She has some OCD tendencies, as she put in the text, but she, from a small child, has always ended her prayers with "Thy will be done," and she struggles with that concept and struggles with making sure she says it exactly right and makes sure that's the proper intent. But you know, that's something that should always be present in our lives, whether we actually say it explicitly, or it should always be implicit in our thoughts. And I'll just kind of illustrate it in a different direction. Yesterday evening, the Cleveland Cavaliers played the San Antonio Spurs in a basketball game. You know, 1 of 82 in a season. What's the big deal? No big deal, except for the fact that LeBron James passed the threshold of 30,000 points. There's only been 6 before him that have done it, and he's the youngest to do it. Well, to show you the ego of this man, the day before he does that, or earlier in the day, he tweets a message to himself. He wants to be among the first to congratulate young LeBron, speaking in third person, for passing reaching this accomplishment later on this evening. And you know, his ego, and he's a jerk. He's very prideful, and you know, typical of pro athletes, but maybe worse than many. And so that's something that kind of crossed the radar of me and Josh and Jeremiah, and we were having a little discussion about that. Jeremiah showed me the tweet, and it irritated me just because but Josh said, who knows, you know, in the first minute of the game, he might blow out a knee and ruin his career. I mean, things like that could happen. And so that, you know, kind of made me mindful of the text there in James about those prideful individuals who said, we're going to go and spend a year and buy and sell and make a profit. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. And he did manage to stay healthy. He did cross the threshold. But it's kind of funny how tone deaf he was, because everybody's making fun of him the next day. And how young LeBron, you know, got his 30,000 points and using his phrase. So, but that arrogance is there, and we can be not arrogant like that, but we can be a little bit presumptuous with regard to our lives, and thinking that we know what's best for us, and thinking that we're going to do this, that, and the other, and we can do that of our own accord without realizing truly God is in control, and we have to acknowledge it.
This is beside the point, but when LeBron James came on the scene as a young player, before he got really in professional, wasn't he considered to be really a nice kid with a lot of good?
Well,
and yet, I was thinking your dad thought pretty much of him to start with.
Because of his style of play, unselfish style of play. In other words, he was a good passer and played a team game.
Yeah.
That's about all you can expect of those guys.
Well, what I'm thinking is you can see what a professional level or college or anything else can do to a kid.
Yeah. But to be honest, with Tiger Woods and LeBron James both, their pridefulness and arrogance has been present all along. And it's because both of them were prodigious players, in other words, they've always dominated the competition, and they've always been told you're the greatest. Tiger Woods was 5 years old, and he was on the Tonight Show hitting golf balls with whoever was there before. Maybe it was Johnny Carson, but anyway, he was on the Tonight Show hitting golf balls, and everybody, he's going to be, you know, wonderful, a great player. And so when you're told that so often, and there's always yes men that'll tell you everything you want to know. Yeah, I really sometimes it's a little off, but it does indicate something that I think is important for us is that you know, how important it is for us, especially as we're raising our children, not to affirm their worth and value so much that they get a skewed concept of their place in the world. And there is that tendency. So, you know, I always told my kids is that, you know, it's all right to accept praise, but be humble and say thank you, and let others sound your accomplishments and sound them out rather than talking about them yourself. I said, you know, that's important. Yeah,
you know, I always told the kids, you don't have to say that you are. People will tell you are. You don't have to.
Yeah, and it's inappropriate. It's very tone deaf for LeBron to do that, because he has that reputation of being extremely arrogant. You know, it's one of those. In the NBA, it's a little bit different, because in the NFL and other sports, you can't run the team yourself. But the coach is the coach because LeBron wanted him to be the coach. The other coaches run off because LeBron wanted to run off. The players that have cut, he's got on the team with him now are because he signed off on them to come in free agency and develop. So all, he's got all that power, and no one's going to say no to him. And it's just, it just makes you sick to your stomach
for people to get that area. I thought that he had a scandal earlier in his career.
No, he's actually not. He, of course, I'm sure he's got, I don't think his children, I don't think he's married, or at least wasn't married when he had his kids and all, so there's that kind of thing. But that, Kobe Bryant may be who you're thinking of, who was accused of rape, and that was a big scandalous thing. With LeBron, the big scandal was that he left Cleveland to go to Miami because he wasn't winning championships in Cleveland. He wanted to win championships, so he went down to Miami and kind of had a super team built around him. And then when that started falling apart, then he moved back to Cleveland and tried to get another super team around him. And, you know, it's all about LeBron. All about LeBron. So that's, but again, that kind of situation is the idea of self-sufficiency and arrogance and pridefulness that is present. It's just...
other people fall along.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mentioned, the sycophants that would tell him if everything he wanted to hear. Jeremiah said he had to look up sycophants, but he agreed with me. So,
okay. Say the word again.
Sycophants. It's individuals who tell you what you want to hear so that they can benefit themselves. You know, they want to be in his shadow. They want to benefit from his money and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, they'll tell him he's the greatest and better than sliced bread and everything he does is right. And, you know, and the problem is that extends out to the media. I want to get an exclusive interview with him sometime. I want to be shunned away, so I'm going to tell him what he wants to hear too. It's just but the point that I wanted to make in regard to that with our children is that we corrupt them if we do that. The reason why LeBron is the way he is because he's grown up being told how important and special he is his entire life, and there is kind of a philosophy in the world today that's what we need to do with our children. That's equivalent to nurturing our children. And what we do is that's one thing they've talked about with millennials in our day and time is that they, these are kind of asides, but it's an interesting thing. Women's March, the one right after Trump was elected, there was a million women that descended upon Washington, D.C. with this march. Well, it's been a year now, so they had another march. A lot smaller because they wasn't the immediate reaction to the election, but there were some signs out there. And one sign was being held by a woman immigrant, DACA, and she said, in effect, the sign said, we're not going to rest until we get what we want. Said, America, you owe us. We want free housing, free food, free, and just all these free things, and you owe us. And then at the bottom of the sign, it said, we're not going to stop killing cops in Arizona until we get it. and they're actually carrying that sign around. But that idea of entitlement that's so present. And, when you started giving participation trophies in soccer and telling kids that they were the best ever and nobody should offend them and it's all about them and everything, they get that message. Well, they believe it because they've been told that since they were very young. And, we were raised to where...
I sure wish the government would look at me as they owed me.
Yeah, that's right, because that's not it. No, you owe everybody else, is what the government said. But, we told our children... at last, they were put in their place. Children should be seen but not heard. Those kinds of things. That you have a place, you'll get to be a center of attention at some time in the future. But you need to understand where you are now. And I don't think children felt like they were being neglected. Mm-hmm. Not the ones that were raised well in those situations. They were learning respect. They were learning their place in the world, and they're not getting that anymore in a lot of places. And society in general is not the case. So again, it's not surprising now that to draw it back to spiritual matters. When we talk about who knows what's best for us, people go to church and choose where they're going to go and what their religion is going to be about based upon their own whims, what they desire, what's best for them. And you have a religious system in place, at least in America, and I think in other places as well, that caters to that. You know, just tailor make it the way you want it and what fits best for you, to where you get out of religion what you want. And it's not about man, it's about God. And that's kind of where that's the kind of emphasis here is that don't complain about your life and your circumstances, situations. Be content. This is the place where you are. God knows what's best. And don't think that you know better than Him. It's God who knows what's best for us, and God who knows what's going to come next, and we can't know those things. So, we kind of got a little far field, but we came back to it. No, that's okay. Fine. That's fine. This is a good discussion. Okay, any questions, comments about that? Verse 12. All right, then let us get into the questions, the discussion questions, to prompt additional insight. Okay, everyone understands that life is not perfect. But the point being made here is that there are benefits, and it may even be just strengthening through tribulation, the benefits that can come even from difficulties in our lives. And so what he has is a list of seven things here that I can be thankful for, things that you wouldn't necessarily be thankful for because. And it's putting a silver lining on each of these. But there's some legitimacy to them. So let's see what y'all put with it. And it probably most of the time it will kind of line up with mine. But why should you be thankful for the taxes you pay?
Because we have money to live on.
Do what?
Because we have money to live on.
Because you still have some left over? I guess, yeah.
Yeah. Because
the government only takes half of it. Well, yeah, okay, so that's an indication, because there are a lot of individuals who don't
pay. You're not going to be paying taxes.
There are a lot of people that don't pay taxes, and that means they don't make money, or they're cheating the government one.
I don't think I get that.
What's the purpose of taxation?
To run our government for public things like parks and highways, even though they've worked on 35 for the last 10 years and haven't gotten anywhere.
Got finished. Yeah. They got some big, tall bridges to go across now, though.
They're a lot of
senior. 35 to 20. So that's the idea, and the military protection. So, it's a little bit onerous to pay the taxes. We sure don't like to take them out of our pockets, but we wouldn't have the infrastructure, if nothing else, infrastructure and defense. Those are the two most important things if we did not do that. So, yeah, too many taxes, but at least we are receiving services for those taxes, for the taxation. Okay, the clothes that I fit that fit too snug. why should have I? So that's probably an obvious
I'm eating too well.
Yeah, that's right. You got plenty to eat. So yeah, rather do that than have a distended belly that comes from malnutrition. Thankful for a lawn that needs mowing and windows that need cleaning because?
Have a home.
Good. Yeah. These are probably pretty obvious. Spot I find at the far end of the parking lot because it means?
You have a car.
Yeah. And you have an opportunity for exercise. Have an opportunity to exercise a little bit too. Yeah. Yeah, I have transportation. The higher than normal heating bill because it means what?
I'm warm.
Yeah. My air conditioning bill has been high my entire adult life because my wife wants to be cool. And that is something that I have said, okay, all right, for her well-being and happiness, we're going to just bite the bullet in the summer. And
now done. You realize I'm going to have to hang on to that for 2 weeks. Until your wife,
she knows it. She knows it. She turns in the middle of winter we turn the temperature down. It's of course our house is old house, so it even down to 72 it feels colder when the heater's not running. If it's just kicked off, but we'll turn it down and get in bed, and she has to have the fan on high, ceiling fan above us, because she has to have that air moving. So she has her. She gets under the bedspread, and I get under the bedspread and 2 blankets. And we're both happy. So, as long as I don't get uncovered in the middle of the night.
They were telling us to turn our thermostats down to 68. That's too cold for me.
Oh, yeah.
I had to put on more clothes.
Yeah. But you have clothes put on, so there's another thing to thank you for. So, yeah, that warm. Okay, piles of my children's laundry. Now, why would you be thankful for that?
Because it means you have clothes.
And you have clothes and have children. And you have children.
That's right. The clothes and have children. That's good.
I was just saying they had clothes.
Yeah, that's good. You have clothes for your children that you have. And then weary and achy muscles at the end of the day, because it means what?
You're alive. I have health. I ate because I exercised.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking that maybe the idea was is the ability to care for my family. I was thinking of a man's position because so many manual labor and having to work hard, and so they're tired and achy, but they put food on the table. So yeah, there's so all those things.
Pretty much the same with women. They're able to clean house and do whatever they need to do, but you do ache and hurt from them sometimes.
But all of those things kind of indicate the point that he was trying to make, and you know, we can, all of those things typically, we gripe about our taxes, we upset at ourselves because our clothes are too tight, and all those kinds of things, oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, and the bills are too high and all, but it just there are certain things that means that are blessings, and it's two ways of looking at it, cup half empty, half full, you know, type things. All right, someone said, I spent most of my life searching for the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, then I finally found it at the foot of the cross. Discuss. I'm going to have to learn that technique when I ask my discussion questions. Just make a statement and say, discuss. Oh, man. So what, anything you want to say about that? Do I need to start the discussion? I'm reminded of the text of Matthew 16 in verse 26. What shall a man prosper if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? And that's kind of what we've got, is the sentiment that's expressed in the book of Ecclesiastes. Solomon's looking for the pot of gold to be in the rainbow, what life is all about. And at the end of it, he says, the conclusion is, fear God, keep his commandments, which in the new covenant has reference to acknowledging the lordship of Christ. So, but that's kind of the whole sentiment of the book of Ecclesiastes. I guess he puts it within that context of being content. But the spiritual, Matthew 6, seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all the needful things will be added to you, is another a passage would be applicable, excuse me, at that time. Anybody else? Next question, if contentment is a learned trait, how do we learn it? That's good. I've learned in whatever state I am to be content.
You dwell on the positive.
Okay.
And things do get bad in life, but they too shall pass.
Okay. Mitzi, what did you say?
Meditate.
Meditation, okay. Yeah, that's kind of tied up in that in Philippians. That's the point that he makes, to meditate on the good things and the trustworthy things of life. I've got two things here that's slightly different, but one is contentment is learned through experience in part, and I think that's kind of the way the approach that Solomon took to it. So you can learn the need for contentment if you've tried the other things that don't bring contentment. That's what Solomon did. That's a bad way of learning, though. Trial and error, because of the consequences of learning those things. And Solomon suffered a lot in his life because he didn't figure this out until late in life. And maybe didn't fully apply the things that he learned to his own lives. But the second thing is that idea of learning from others, you know, seeking wise counsel. So if you open your minds to truths in general, the truths of God's Word, the truths that those who have applied God's Word have found in their own lives, and you heed those things, and you say, okay, yeah, I can learn these lessons without having to experience the downside of it myself. And that's I think, a key. And I think it's why the book of Ecclesiastes, as well as others, were written so that we wouldn't have to do what they did to find out the same lesson that they did. Those who do not learn from history are doomed to repeat it. But if we can learn from what someone else has tried, that wasn't it. That didn't help. That didn't bring contentment. Then maybe that would be helpful to us. All right, 700 wives, 300 concubines. That's 1,000 women. Solomon fathered an untold number of children. untold because the Bible doesn't tell us exactly how many. But in Ecclesiastes 6 and verse 3, he said, if a man begets 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with goodness, or indeed he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better than he. So can we read between the lines as to what he might have been afraid of? Is there anything in Solomon's life that you read of in other places that would indicate that his children might not respect him, or he might be fearful of his end?
I just kept repeating your things bad.
They probably wouldn't even know him.
What about his brother? Did he have any brothers who acted treacherously? Yeah, I was thinking Absalom as an example, and not knowing the exact relationship that they had and such. But can you imagine Solomon seeing his father in fear for his life because his own son committed that treachery against him? And he would have witnessed that. He would have seen what was going on. And maybe even wonder to himself if he indeed had the respect for his father. It seemed that he did. Is how his brother could be that way, trying to take over the kingdom and try to kill his own father. So he could see from that how treacherous children can be. Like you said, the fact that it was as it was. Number one, the fact that he was the king, so there was an exalted position that others would seek to usurp, possibly. Number two, if he had that many children, he probably didn't have a good relationship with a lot of them, or much of a relationship at all with them. So it would be a peculiar situation that we don't necessarily have. But there is that lesson. You see it happening all the time today, is where children either do not respect their parents, or their values are different, or even disobedience and rebellion that caused them to leave or to not have any dealings with their parents. So those kinds of things come up, to where that statement, which does seem a little bit of a overblown to us perhaps, but the idea is you can't know for a certainty how you'll be treated by your children. And so the idea that, okay, well, the value of life is going to be found in my family. It's hard for me to go so far as to say vain, because of the joy that my children bring me, but the fact that that's not what life's all about. And that's, I think, a lot of times what people think as well, is that my life is about my family. And anytime you've got that improper priority, it's dangerous. But that's what came to my mind when I read Ecclesiastes 6:3, is that David's own son tried to kill him, and Solomon would have been aware of it. Question number five, verse 12 of the text. Who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life which he passes like a shadow. Who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? Life is futile only when we spend it on the wrong things. The problem is we don't always know what we want. People say, if only I could marry that woman, or live in that house, or work for that company, or own one of those things. The if-only world, they're never going to be happy. The question is, have you known anyone like that? Maybe I'm sure that all of us have and do know people who are so caught up in gaining and obtaining and searching for happiness in that way. I think a more pertinent question, and I won't ask for hands for this because it is a personal thing, but have you ever been that way at any time in your life? And I think that there's a real danger of that even among Christians. And I think that we could have it to a lesser extent than what we see in others too. So we think, well, I'm not like him, so I'm okay. In reality, there's a little bit too much of that desire for things in our lives as well. Materialism that you see present in the world. I don't want a Lexus, but a,
a brand new Chevrolet sure would be nice. I don't know, I'd be happy if I had that. So I'm not reaching really high, but I sure would like, you know, so we could, you know, I'm not like that guy. He wants a yacht. I just like a bass boat or whatever. We can fool ourselves into thinking, I suppose, that we're not as others are and still be guilty of being too materialistic, and that's and lacking.
But you never be satisfied.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You'll talk to people who have things, and they will say, "Yes, this is nice, but," and I realize that this isn't important. And I don't begrudge individuals who have made some financial decisions that have benefited them, or been fortunate enough to be in a successful business or something like that. If having that money, that's not the problem. It's not the money money can cause issues and certainly raise temptations that others may not have. But it's the desire and love for money that causes the problems, and so often the ones who get it are the ones who are desiring it and wanting it. That's the problem, because it's not easy to get rich. Some people fall into it, but with most, it takes a lot of hard work, some good fortune, but a get out and get it mentality a lot of times you see with rich people, they neglect their families. They, working their fingers to the bone and trying to get ahead, and it may be successful in doing that, but it's something that just takes over their lives, and so there's no room for God in that. And that's the problem. So that's what I got from that question, is that we all could be guilty of that. We need to be careful to one extent or another. Then the final question. Concerning that phrase, all the days of his own life, which he passes like a shadow, or spends like a shadow. At what age do you think we begin to realize that life is very short? It's an interesting question to ask. Have y'all reached the point, any of you, where you think life is just pretty short?
Yeah.
I think it comes with age, I do, really.
Well, it seems that I'm the youngest in the group, and I feel that way, so yeah. It does. You begin to think about that, your own mortality, and
my youngest child has said all of her life it's going too fast.
Yeah, it does pass quickly.
It's always surprised me to hear that out of her, because no kidding, she was very, very young the first time I heard her say it. Used to worry me.
Yeah.
Is she doomed to die young? But she's old now.
She's all right. She's just had that. But it's a good mindset to have, I suppose, unless you become anxious because of it. But yeah, it's a relative thing. But even a long lived life is relatively short in the great scheme of things. And you think about, I'd like to live long enough to see my kids grow up, and then I'd like to be live long enough to see my grandkids grow up, and then they all of a sudden they've got kids. Hey, I'd like to be live long enough to see my great grandkids grow up. Eventually got to stop here somewhere.
Yeah. And you look back and you say, oh, where did that happen? Yeah.
Time passes quickly. I was looking on some videos that I prepared, and I think it's been 5 or 6 years ago is what it was, but this beard that I've grown, I've kept for a long, long time, and I've never done that before, but that beard had no gray in it. Only 5 or 6 years ago, had no gray. Yeah, real dark and no gray. And I thought, okay, well, things have changed.
So, we've all watched that. Huh?
Yeah, I know.
We know.
Yeah, I know.
And, happens to all of us.
I probably
do this.
Yeah. So that's things are changing. Yeah, when I got here, I was 28 years old. And
it seemed like yesterday, didn't it?
It does. It's been a long, long time.
I remember when you come. I don't remember how old you were, but I remember.
Well, in August, it'll be 29 years total. Yeah, so. So, trying to get to August, 2019, and 30 years. Get my, pin or medal or something. Watch, get watch. All right. Okay, so. There you go. All right, so we then have gotten through it. Anybody have any questions about chapter 6 then? Finish that up. Okay, let's go ahead and get into chapter 7. And I won't try to read it all. One of the reasons why is because each of these are kind of couplets, pithy sayings, self-contained somewhat, kind of like the Book of Proverbs. And the point that he is making in this particular chapter is that we've reached kind of a halfway point. There's 12 chapters and we finished the sixth. And that there's a slight change in tone in the text. And the thing is, you can't make just a straight demarcation line between, okay, vanity of vanities, the first six chapters, and then all of a sudden this is what wisdom is in the last six. But there is a tone change that is there. And so he begins to focus on what happens when you're no longer focused on that which is under heaven or under the sun. Instead, you're looking beyond those things as to what's most important. And he says it, he puts it at the end of that second paragraph, not counting the scripture references at the top. Said the terms wise and wisdom occur 30 times in the latter half of the book. It's because Solomon is finding his way home. Like the prodigal's pilgrimage, the king is finally taking a turn to the right in wise direction. Well, again, that's in the focus of the book, because this book is written at the end of all of this, and he's talking about what he tried and what he's realizing and understanding. So he begins to use that kind of style that you see in the book of Proverbs, brief and simple sounding truths that offer insight for practical living. And it starts out in chapter 7 with seven comparative proverbs. And what that means is that one thing is better than the other thing. He's comparing one thing with another. And so that's what the first largest portion of this lesson, pages 32 and 33, are about, and those seven better than truths or better than statements. And so it's good. It's a good study. So the first one, verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death better than the day of one's birth. So those are two there. So let's start first. A good name is better than ointment. Looking at what he has to say here, talking about a good reputation. That's what we think about when we talk about good name, is being preferred or better than expensive cologne or perfume. So that's kind of the ointment, the purpose of the ointment. And by the way, remember that they didn't have quite the access to hygiene that we had. And so the ointments and things, though expensive, those who could afford them would use them to make them smell better, make things a little bit more pleasant. And fragrance was something that was well respected. It was a sign of luxury at that time. So what he does indicate here is he's not saying, whenever you see these better thans, it isn't necessarily indicating that the lesser thing is not valuable or have benefits or values to them. It's just what is more important. There I'm reminded of the study that we did of Mary and Martha recently, where Mary chose the better part and it would not be taken away from her. Martha, you're doing something that's good, you're being hospitable, that's important, but Mary has chosen to listen to me, and that's more important, that's the better thing. So it's not a reason to denigrate the lesser thing unless there is some real reason for it, which isn't the case here. But it's saying what's more important than that. And so it emphasizes the importance of reputation. Now he points out that advertisers know this. Establishing a brand and having that brand to be something that is indicative of quality or of integrity or dependability. Those things are very important. They'll even if they don't have integrity and their product is not dependable or valuable, they'll try to create advertisements to make you think that because it's so important. If they can establish the name or the reputation, then that's going to help them in their service. And so we see that quite often in advertising. But the application there is with regard to people, that people have reputations as well. And the book of Matthew in the 5th chapter with the Sermon on the Mount, the idea of being the light of the world or the salt of the earth, how many times we're told to have that kind of influence. And he indicated that his parents and his father is Wilson Adams. I mean, his name's Wilson Adams, so his father's Connie Adams. So if you know Connie Adams and I don't know that any of you have ever met his first wife, Bobby. You may have met his second wife, Bobby. I think, if I remember right, both of his wives had the same first name. But anyway, so he said his parents told him, drive safely and remember your name. And that's just a succinct way of talking about the importance of reputation, that what you do is something that influences the way people think about you and your family, and to remember that. And it doesn't take long to destroy a reputation. He's got the text in chapter 10, verse 1. Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor, and so does a little folly to one who's respected for wisdom and honor. Now, we have seen that just recently about individuals not that saying this guy's a good person because he's a profane comedian and such, but his name, he's from the Middle East, Ansir something, Safari or something like that. It's a peculiar name, but he's pretty well known. He was on a couple of TV shows. And the reason I'm aware of him is that I read an article where he had been in this Me Too movement, where the women now are saying that I've been sexually assaulted or sexually abused or harassed in workplaces whenever Harvey Weinstein and all these others became exposed. Well, he was very active in promoting that movement at the very beginning and saying that we should have more respect for women and all of this, and was kind of at the forefront of that movement. Well, a woman who saw him doing that just couldn't take it anymore and talked about an interaction that she had with him where he sexually harassed her. So now he's in the position now of denying it too. No, I didn't. It was consensual. And it sounds like maybe it was consensual to a certain extent. That doesn't, of course, validate it all because it was still sexual immorality. But it may or may not have been. But for the people in that movement who were extolling him as one of the guys, one of the few men that get it, now all of a sudden his name is mud from them too because of this indiscretion, or claimed indiscretion. And of course, part of that movement is that if a woman makes the claim, then she should be believed. No, she should be believed because even if we some men are mistreated because of it, we've been mistreated for so long, it's worth it to throw a few under the bus that don't deserve to be in there to get our place. And that's kind of the way the movement has gone in that regard, which is scary to me as a preacher, because preachers are vulnerable in that regard. Of course, I've always made it a practice to make sure that my interactions with women have always been with Debbie at my side. But, an accusation, even false, can ruin a reputation. So I don't know if the guy, I mean, he was definitely trying to pick up a woman who he had just met, because it was one of those first date type things, and it was in his intended purpose. Whether he actually assaulted her or not, who knows? But it ruined his reputation, that one thing, with that group of people. And so, you know, there's a lot of truth to be found in that. And to be honest, if I want to use that same concept of sexual indiscretions, there have been a number of preachers who have been found guilty of those things, who were just powerful preachers and had a tremendous ability to influence people, who have been marginalized entirely because of their indiscretions. And it's a shame, but it's true. It happens, and it's their own fault. You know, it's not that I feel sorry for them necessarily. They shouldn't have done what they've done, and I feel sorry for those that they've, you know, the wives, because they were adulterous relationships. I feel sorry for the wives, not them. But at the same time, that voice that was so effective is gone as a result of it. So it's a real truth that reputation is extremely important. And there are times when your reputation will be sullied through no fault of your own. And you have to work through that and just recognize that that can happen. But you can destroy your own reputation. Most often that's what happens. Very dangerous thing. So a good name is better than good ointment. Anybody else? I don't want to rush through them. If you have anything you want to add, feel free to. Okay, the second one, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. And that is very, very difficult for us if we are not looking beyond the sun to understand and recognize. And most people don't do that. So, but the reason why that is true is obvious, I think, to us. We've studied this and emphasized it enough. The text he uses in Philippians chapter 1 has reference to Paul's imprisonment. We'll be talking about that on Sunday morning pretty soon. And his statement, for to me to live is Christ, but to die is gain. And the reference is, of course, his recognition that once he dies, he'll go to be with Christ, which is far better. And that's why the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth. It could not be true unless there is a God. And it cannot be true unless you are a servant of that God, that is so. But it is, if that is the case. So I suppose in saying that, the day of one's death is better than the day of one's birth, is it's a statement that is not true for everyone. In fact, not true for most. But that's the intimation here, is for a righteous man that's so.
Part of what he's getting at, though, especially when you read the scripture more than this, is when people go to funerals, they start thinking about death. When you start thinking about death, you have to evaluate your life and what it's been like. And to me, that's part of what the scripture is actually saying in this case. And for us as Christians, then, we also know we have the hope of heaven. And so that especially is meaningful to us. But I do think that most people, when they are attending a funeral, stop and think about death and evaluate their life.
Which would tie in with the couplets in Ecclesiastes 3, it is better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting.
Yeah.
The lessons of life are learned at the house of mourning. And there's a lot of truth to be found in that. I thought it's kind of interesting when I went to we had opportunity to go to Frank Walton's father's funeral, and as the funeral was beginning, it was being held in the church building. I didn't really notice it because the drone was just, I mean, you walk in, it was going off. The baptistry was running, the circulation pump in the baptistry was running, and it was fairly loud. And you noticed it after they turned it off, but it was fairly loud. But, you know, because it was running when we walked in, it really wasn't noticeable. It was white noise. But the preacher got up, and the first thing he did is he got up to start. He realized what was going on, and he turned to one of the deacons and said, asked him if he'd go turn off the pump on the baptistry. He started off by saying, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if this funeral ended with a baptism? And he said, and we're prepared if need be, but brother so-and-so, would you please go turn the baptistry pump off so it'd be quieter in here? So he turned it off and it was quiet and he went on. But I thought that was kind of interesting because, you know, as a preacher, when I preach a funeral, there are those things in mind that there's that acknowledgement that what we say has no bearing upon the internal standing of the individual. But those who remain behind can be impacted by the message. And that's why it's such an important time. And it's one of the reasons why, where typically I have minimal, not say minimal notes, but my notes are in my preaching are much less extensive. When I preach a funeral, I'm almost reading a text. I almost write it out word for word because I don't want to say the wrong thing. And I want to be careful the way I word it because I'm mindful of individuals in the audience who may not be Christians, may have never heard the gospel preached before, and who may be offended if I'm preaching a funeral of someone who's not a Christian, and I've had to do that, might be offended if I you know, if I misspeak or say something that they would construe as is condemning their loved one who's passed on. And so you've got to be mindful of all those things, because what you're striving to do at a very vulnerable time in their life is to influence them for righteousness. And it's not an easy thing to do in those times, but it's an important thing. But as Patsy has indicated, it is at those times that our minds are attuned to that. So people begin thinking about their own mortality, thinking about what they have been lacking in. If it's a Christian who has died, they're thinking about how good a person that person was and how they want to be better, to be more like them. And if you can emphasize what made them what they were, or the change that was affected in their life when they became a child of God, or all those kinds of things, it can be something to make them think about their own circumstances. And as a result of that, maybe turn to the Lord. So that's the effort, at least, in preaching, if you will. I've said a lot of times that I'd rather preach a funeral than a wedding, and I have to explain myself when I say that. Number one, nobody's going to learn anything at a wedding, or very, very, very few things, even though I'll try. But people are not interested in the preaching; they're interested in the bride and groom. You learn more in the funeral, but and then there's all the things that the weddings are a headache. Funerals aren't so much. So there's that part of it as a preacher. But you know, a primary thing is that the importance of the event, the death, is what can be accomplished through the message. Is a good point. So there's that, and then there's this point of an individual who is faithful to the Lord. Revelation 14:13, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord. Their deeds follow them. And the importance of that. Now, he also mentions in Hebrews 11:4 that your name and reputation live on. So we can certainly see that in the life of the Apostle Paul, because of his success, that there are so many who have come to Christ as a result of his teaching and his words, even though he's been dead for 2,000 years. His epistles are very influential. Okay, questions, comments about the second couplet? Okay, third one then in verse 2, and we'll have time for that and we'll have to stop, is it's better to go to the house of mourning than the house of feasting, which is what we alluded to. Am I confused on that? Yeah, okay. So yeah, I'm just, what I was thinking about when I said Ecclesiastes 3 was actually that verse, but the reference is a time to mourn and a time to dance in Ecclesiastes 3:4. So this is the verse actually that I was referencing. So we've already made an allusion to that as you go on, as Patsy said, and it's better to go to the house of mourning, house of feasting. Second part of that. So we've pretty much talked about that section of soul searching. Anybody have anything to add? Because we pretty much covered that as well. All right. And then the next one in verses 3 and 4 of the text. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Sorrow is better than laughter. You don't learn anything. Well, you learn less by laughing. I mean, they don't. You know, it's something to where the most important life lessons are learned through trial and tribulation. That's something that's established so many times, even in James 1, when James talks about the blessed in temptation, in being proven, you receive the crown of life. If patience has its perfect work, we become patient as a result of the tribulations that we have. So there's so much to be said with regard to that. He says here that joke stories and one-liners have their place, but they don't last. And I would think that. I mean, it's typical for preachers. A lot of preachers, even when they're preaching, to kind of a lot of them want to be funny, and they'll even have jokes as a part of their sermon, or illustrations that are amusing, anecdotes, those kinds of things. But you know, think about the most powerful sermons that you've heard, talking about judgment and accountability, and and dealing with sin and those kinds of things. Those are the ones that stick. It's not necessarily pleasant, but the important lessons are learned as a result of that. So death gives us needed perspective. That's a good point to be made there. So when we're talking about this, and that change, the crush going over to wisdom, these couplets that are mentioned in this situation, it is indicative of that mindset of what comes after the grave and the importance of what comes after the grave.